just cannot get away from it. So being here today with a naval audience is quite refreshing. In fact, there's these Army, Navy and Air Force officers every Friday afternoon would meet at the Kingston Hotel there in Canberra. And you know, as the organisation's always talking about joinery, these three officers would sit there and complain every Friday afternoon. And the Army officer would say, no, Army is the best. We're by far the biggest and we've got the Anzac legend behind us, so Army is the best. And the Air Force officer would say, no. Air Force, we fly further and farther and higher than everybody else. We are by far the best. And of course the Navy says, oh, you can laugh, but we are the senior service and will remain so forever. Anyway, every Friday afternoon, guaranteed, these officers are down at the Kingston Hotel arguing the same old thing. And of course they passed away and died. And they go up to the pearly gates and they start walking through and St. Peter stops them and he says, are you the three officers who meet at the Kingston Hotel every Friday? And they sort of nod and he goes, oh, there's a letter for you. There's a letter from God. And he passes them the letter and he opens it up. They open it up and it says, to the three officers who meet at the Kingston Hotel, I have been listening to you talking now on and on every Friday afternoon about the single service mentality that you maintain, whilst I have been trying to make the organisation joint. We're equal organisations and we fly under the one banner. And you continue to bring my argument down and I am sick and tired of hearing about this. So as you enter the pearly gates, I want to make sure that you are entering a joint organisation and the single service attitude you maintain must be left behind. And it was signed, God. RAN retired. It's always a good one. The Constitution of Australia Act received royal assent on the 9th of July 1900 and came into effect on the 1st of January 1901. At this moment, the separate colonies became states of the Commonwealth of Australia. 13 years later, our nation was at war. On the 4th of August 1914, Great Britain declared war on Germany. And on the 5th of August 1914, the German steamer SS Faust tried to leave the port of Melbourne. She was fired on by Fort Nepean, just south of Melbourne. These shots, incidentally, were the first shots fired in the war. The Faust was requisitioned by the Royal Australian Navy, or the Australian Navy, and refitted as a troop ship, HMT Bora. She carried Australian soldiers to the Mediterranean and Turkish prisoners from the Dardanelles campaign. In 1919, she brought Australia's soldiers home. In 13 years, we had come together as a nation and the Royal Australian Navy was at sea in defence of empire. But we tend not to hear much about the Navy. Tradition holds that the Navy is the silent service. Navy tends to remain in the shadows of our nation's history, so we tend to misunderstand what naval power is. Very few people grasp the way naval planning is enmeshed with politics at the level of grand strategy. So let me fill out those remarks. In 13 years, the Royal Australian Navy grew from the mishmash of colonial navies transferred to the Commonwealth control on Federation. These, and I will say so-called navies, were token forces confined to harbour protection. The significance of that remark is in the confinement of the colonial navies to harbour defence. People did not look beyond the beach to the ocean. The sense was not that we were a maritime nation, dependent upon the sea. Look at the early Australian Impressionists, and you will see the Australian self-concept in the bush. But when the Australian fleet steamed into Sydney in 1913, it was a fleet suited very much more than harbour defence. So So what happened? How did a nation that was young and very far from populous and very far from economically rich manage to acquire such a fleet in such a short time? We know that officially the Royal Australian Navy was constituted on the 10th of July 1911, when King George V granted the Commonwealth Naval Forces the designation of the Royal Australian Navy. Thus, Commonwealth Naval Order No. 77 on the 5th of October 1911 reads, His Majesty the King has been graciously pleased to approve of the permanent naval force of the Commonwealth being designated the Royal Australian Navy and of the ships of that navy being designated as His Majesty's Australian ships. But in reality, this is just surface gloss. The providence of the Navy reflects a far-sighted strategic vision, Creswell's vision. The Commonwealth Defence Act 1904 enabled the appointment by Prime Minister Reid of Captain W.R. Creswell as Commonwealth Director of Naval Forces. It was as a Director of Naval Forces that Creswell came to sit on the Board of Naval Administration. From this position, Creswell dragged the colonial navies together into a single institution with a centralised administration. This institution, called the Commonwealth Naval Forces, was organised in 1907, a mere 7 years before the Great War. But though the institution was drawn together, the ships were weak, and the naval defence of Australia continued to be reliant on the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy ships were not much to write home about. In 1908, when the Great White Fleet visited Australia, an officer on the USS flagship, Connecticut, noted that with the exception of HMAS Powerful, the Australian station looked like an unimportant society posting suited to cocktails, but nothing serious. Creswell was a realist and a visionary. In September 1905, he said, "The naval service is practically on the verge of collapse. Appearing to represent to the public a defence which could not be rendered if called upon." Rather than complacency, Creswell urged action. Very far from content with the status quo, Creswell saw the need for a great leap forward. He grasped the truth that peace is assured only by military strength. So Creswell looked ahead. Similarly, we must now also look ahead. We must not be content with the status quo. We must not deceive ourselves that ships, which are now new, will be the solution to our needs forever. Australia is blessed with her strategic geography, but there has never been a time when we might have claimed to be unassailable. Creswell looked from our shores to a world defined as the world continues to be defined by Thucydides. The strong will do what they can and the weak will bear what they must. Creswell died in 1933. In the intervening 8 decades, politics has not changed. Politics continues to be Clausewitzian, all about power and dominated by war's spectre. I reference the British diplomat Sir Ernest Satow. Satow claimed international politics dependent upon intelligence and tact. But in fact, that is a superficial reading of the way things are. Recall the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who said, "Covenants without swords are but words, and of no strength to secure a man at all." Politics is dominated by power, by the threat of war, and the need to avert war or to win it. Theodore Roosevelt put this memorably, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." The latter is well known. Si vi pacem, para bellum. If you want peace, prepare for war. And it was Sir Walter Raleigh who said, "Whosoever commands the sea commands the trade. Whosoever commands the trade of the world commands the riches of the world and consequently the world itself." Recalling Raleigh, my point concerns the imperative of sea control. We must maintain the security and good order at sea. We must make incursions perilous for our adversaries. The sense that an incursion must be perilous for our adversary gestures to Mahan, who famously said, the possession of overbearing power on the sea, which drives the enemy from it, or allows it to appear only as a fugitive, and which, by controlling the great common, being the ocean, closes the highways by which commerce moves and from the enemy's shores, to and from the enemy's shores. So in the modern era, how do we do this? In the modern era, sea control, in the sense that this phrase might once have been used, is not feasible for any one nation. Strategy, as Stanford Turner observed, must be paid for, and the cost of overbearing dominating power at sea are beyond the reasonable scope of any one nation. Second, the sort of ships which might exercise this sort of control or power are exposed to the menace of the submarine. So my answer is in two parts. First, in the modern era, we project power at sea by alliances. Second, we grasp and we exploit the ominous potentiality of the submarine. I wish to now speak to these two points. When Creswell conceived the Royal Australian Navy, the fleet he envisaged was in fact a very powerful unit, designed to operate in concert with the Royal Navy. His ideas continue to be relevant. Today, the Royal Australian Navy, a warfighting system in its own right, takes station as a constituent part of an alliance and coalition structure, which aim to preserve, to serve in cause, the cause of justice and good order at sea. We are not a subsidiary power. We are a power in our own right, but we do not fight alone. We contribute to the distributed lethality of coalitions. I return now to the submarine, the most daunting and perhaps the most misunderstood part of the equation. Submarines change the strategic calculus in formidable and far-reaching ways. In the maritime environment, the presence, the possible presence of submarines changes the way a fleet operates and changes the way people decide. An example of this is from the Falklands War. In his essay, The Navy and the Nation, Vice Admiral Barrett referenced Admiral Sandy Woodward. Woodward argued, surprisingly, that the Royal Navy submarine did not deter Argentinian invasion. Rather, the submarine menace drove the Argentinians to precipitate action. This was because, for political reasons, the Argentinians had committed to an invasion. They had calculated that the British had neither the force nor the will to prevent an invasion, nor to fight and to eject an invading force. They planned their invasion for the September of 1982. But when the Argentinians noticed the Royal Navy submarine load torpedoes and leave Gibraltar in the late March, they worried that their plans had been tumbled. And they knew that if the Royal Navy could sustain an SSN in the South Atlantic, that such an SSN would make an invasion of the Falklands unworkable. As a consequence, the Argentinians went months early and invaded within days. Deterrence failed. The British could not deter, and they did not deter the Argentinians. But the strategic influence of the submarine is established. Leaving Gibraltar, the mere possibility that a submarine might be on station upset the strategic calculus in dramatic fashion. The Argentinian command decided that the only chance of success was to launch operations before the submarine could play a part. And of course, the strategic influence of the submarine is demonstrated further in the sinking of Belgrano. By this action, the Royal Navy submarines did deter Argentinian surface actions. In consequence, the Argentinians relied on a failed strategy of passive defence of the islands, the projection of air power into a contested maritime domain against a powerful and resolute British task force. I'm going to sheet this point home by saying, firstly, the British failed to demonstrate intent by regularly deploying their submarines to the South Atlantic. Had they done so, then it is plausible to suggest that the planning calculus of the Argentinians may have been markedly different. Diplomacy may have endured. Secondly, submarines cannot deter as a capability alone. There must be a demonstrated sense of readiness, and there must be the support infrastructure which makes it possible to keep submarines on station. Some of these points will come out now as I go to speak about Australian submarines in particular. In the Australian context, since we do not possess nuclear weapons, we rely upon the alliance with the United States. It is this alliance which puts the ultimate damper on incursion by any great power adversary. In our own right, Australian deterrence obtains from the submarines, which, by conventional means, imposes unacceptable risk on incursion. Our submarines are very powerful. If an aggressor were to attempt to cross the sea to so as harm our nation or our interests, rest assured that aggressor should expect to fail. Our submarines are suited to the archipelagic Indo-Pacific region and are prepared to sink ships and submarines. We do not keep our submarines tied up alongside. We keep our submarines at sea, ready. There are 4 boats at sea now, out of 6. These submarines will soon be deployed throughout the region, demonstrating Australia's resolve to the maintenance of peace and security. They represent a threat to any adversary, and thus they offer Australian diplomacy real-world power, which is cardinal to real-world influence. With a much greater force of 12 attack-class submarines, Australia will be able to sustain an even more compelling submarine presence in the region. This is the deterrence concept, which was detailed in the 2016 Defence White Paper, where government specified Australia's submarines capability as the nation's big stick. Each Collins today carries a large number of the joint US-Australian Mark 48 Mod 7 Seabass torpedo. Perhaps some don't understand the threat these weapons pose. But with about 20 weapons on each submarine, which doesn't sound like much weapons to many, but these are sophisticated weapons, they're highly reliable, they're highly accurate, and they're highly effective. In all realities, if fired, you can expect that one weapon will find its target and it will sink it, even the most capable of capital ships or submarine. Since our submarines are stealthy and since they operate over significant ranges and endure on station for considerable periods of time, we might reasonably say Australian submarines offer substantial menace and significant deterrence to any adversary. No military off-the-shelf solution could solve this problem for Australia. And Australia must have submarines. Justice, the rule of law, and good order at sea depend upon submarines, but they are often misunderstood and underestimated. And the same was true in Creswell's time. Creswell was a modernist. He was ahead of his time in warning of the maritime threat to Australia and Australia's economy, and ahead of his time in urging a sea-blind nation to build a navy. But Creswell was focused on surface forces, and at the time he was probably right. Submarines, properly called submersibles, were largely experimental. They were weak in stability, seakeeping, range and capability. With a range of only 3,000 nautical miles, the first Australian submarines, A1 and A2, had done nothing to alter preconceptions. Acquired with the fleet unit as assets suitable for local defence, the submarines had been alternately towed by surface warships for much of their 12,000 nautical mile delivery to Australia. After their arrival in May 1914, both submarines had gone straight into refit. Repairs and maintenance were not completed until after the outbreak of war, and by April 1915, both had been lost, the first to accident and the second to enemy action. Consequently, in 1915, the wider RAN understood neither the rapid advances made in submarine tactics and technology, nor the difficulties involved in dealing with submarines. But after the war, things were different. In fact, after the war, in a newspaper clipping held by the Sea Power Centre, Creswell says, "I do not suppose any human being who could doubt the power and influence of a submarine, seeing how very nearly it decided the war against us. It is true to say that our style is cramped, absolutely by a financial position. But at least some expenditure, even out of proportion to our means, should go toward placing us in a position to have effective submarine defence." The more things changed, the more they stay the same. Though it is a great challenge, our nation must build submarines. And now, under a continuous build program, we will build and evolve submarines alongside our warships, at least for the rest of this century. Our leadership in science and industry, our hopes for peace, for security, for justice, for human rights, for good order and the rule of law, our obligation to ourselves and to others, require us to make this effort, that we build ships and submarines, that we take chances, and that we triumph over adversity that we will inevitably face. To take risk, to serve justice, such an endeavour is in the finest traditions of the Royal Australian Navy. Thank you.
Questions are off. Questions in the US, but I don't know about it. I was over Zoomer.